When you think of the MENA region, it's often, vast deserts, maybe oil wealth. But isn't it striking how you can have abundant natural resources right alongside a private sector that's, well, really struggling to take off? That contrast, highlighted in Lico Business back in April 2025, it's quite something.
It absolutely is. And that special issue from Lico Business, published April 27th, 2025, it really gives us a fascinating window into the key economic debates happening across this vital region. Our goal today is to sort of unpack those articles for you.
Exactly. To give you a clear, concise understanding of the core issues, we'll be touching on the challenges and growth opportunities for the private sector, the absolutely critical role of women.
The whole puzzle of the informal economy, especially in Morocco, those paradoxes around investment and innovation.
Right. And we'll even look at specific countries, Morocco, Tunisia, Egypt, Syria. It's a real economic snapshot.
The main idea is to equip you with the insights to grasp these complex M&A economic dynamics, how they all connect, without, drowning you in excessive detail. Straight to the point, deep understanding.
Okay, let's dive into that private sector then. The one described as so frail. According to that World Bank report from April 2025, it seems like it's a major roadblock to sustainable growth in MENA. We're talking really slow growth, just 1.9% in 2024, and this heavy reliance on the state. What's really behind this weakness?
Well, the analysis points to some deep-seated structural issues. Low productivity is a big one. Think an 8% drop in sales per worker compared to countries with similar income levels.
8% lower. Wow.
Yeah. And then there's just not enough investment. Only about 21.7% in physical capital and even less in training, around 14.5%. Innovation. Yeah. Pretty scarce. You don't see many patent filings or much R&D investment.
And the labor market isn't very inclusive either, is it? I saw a figure about women's participation.
That's right. Only 18% female labor force participation, which is incredibly low compared to the global average of, what, 49%?
18%. That's staggering.
Yeah.
And it seems the state itself is kind of a double-edged sword here.
Precisely. The World Bank highlights how state presence is, well, massive. Dominant public enterprises, regulations that are maybe out of date, subsidies that aren't well targeted, and these clientelist practices, basically, favoritism that really stifle private initiative.
And all this fragility makes the sector really vulnerable to shocks, I imagine.
Totally. Conflicts, political shifts, natural disasters, oil price volatility. It doesn't take much to destabilize things, especially when only a small faction of businesses are formal and maybe have the buffers to cope.
But Lico Business adds a layer of nuance, doesn't it? Asking if focusing solely on the private sector's weaknesses might overlook, say, the impact of poorly managed liberal reforms or the vital role the state can play in social cohesion.
That's a crucial counterpoint. The article suggests, for example, that the informal economy might actually be an adaptation, a way people cope with bureaucratic systems that exclude them. Pushing for formalization across the board without fixing the underlying issues in the business climate, well, that could backfire.
A really important perspective. Okay, let's pivot to another potential growth engine that seems vastly underutilized. The role of women in the economy. That 18% participation figure in MENA versus 49% globally. It really speaks volumes. What's the economic cost of that gap?
The World Bank estimates are pretty stark. They figure that closing these gender gaps could boost per capita income by as much as 50% in a typical MENA country. That's massive growth potential just sitting there, untapped.
50%. So what are the main hurdles keeping women out or holding them back?
It's a mix of complex factors. You've got deep-rooted cultural norms, sometimes restrictive laws, a lack of affordable quality childcare, limited career advancement prospects for women, and even issues around mobility. It's a challenging cycle to break.
Interestingly, the articles noted that businesses led by women actually hire more women.
Exactly. Lico Business points out that on average, women-led firms in MENA employ twice as many women as firms led by men. So supporting female entrepreneurship seems like a really strategic lever for broader female inclusion in the workforce.
Yet the percentage of women actually leading firms is still pretty low, especially in some Gulf countries, right?
Yeah, disturbingly low in some cases, less than 3% compared to nearly 19% in high-income countries. That gap really highlights how much ground still needs to be covered for genuine equality of opportunity and entrepreneurship.
So what kinds of policy solutions are being discussed to boost women's economic inclusion in the region?
The articles mention several key areas. Fair labor laws, tax incentives for companies that are genuinely inclusive, developing subsidized and accessible childcare, actively supporting female entrepreneurs with training and finance, and also economically recognizing unpaid domestic work. which still falls disproportionately on women.
Those sound like concrete steps that can make a real difference.
Yeah.
Now let's tackle the informal economy, using Morocco as a striking example. The World Bank data from April 2025 suggested 83% of Moroccan companies operate informally. That number is just mind-boggling.
It really is. And Leko Business urges us to look beyond the simple view of informality as just being about survival. In Morocco, it's a huge part of daily economic life in trade, crafts, transport, domestic services, you name it.
We're talking 40 to 80% of total employment in some estimates. So far from marginal. But why do so many businesses and workers choose or end up in the informal sector?
It's often a combination of things. The perceived cost of entering the formal sector can be prohibitive. Think complex paperwork, taxes, regulations, sometimes even dealing with corruption. For many, staying informal is also, frankly, a way to avoid what they see as excessive bureaucracy.
But there must be significant downsides and risks for people operating informally.
Oh, absolutely. Lack of access to training, bank credit, proper social protection, legal security. These are major disadvantages. Plus, informal work is often unstable, low paid, and women tend to be overrepresented in the most precarious roles.
Leko Business kind of challenges the purely negative view, though. Even mentioning a technocratic fantasy of trying to force everything into the formal system.
Right. The article suggests that a top-down formalization drive, without tackling the problems within the formal sector itself, like unfair tax distribution or overly complex procedures, is likely to be counterproductive. You could even see the informal economy as a form of, maybe, economic resistance and a source of local solidarity. The key point is that it's a major, if often precarious, part of the economic fabric, suggesting formalization efforts need to be smart and address why people stay informal.
So, given that complex reality, what's a more effective approach?
The thinking leans towards understanding and supporting the informal economy rather than just trying to eliminate it. Things like incentives, easier access to tailored social protection, maybe recognizing hybrid statuses that ease the transition towards formality. Those could be more promising avenues.
Interesting. Okay, let's shift to investment and innovation in MENA. The World Bank report highlighted a paradox. Despite instability, companies aren't investing much in key areas like equipment, training, or R&D. How do we explain that hesitation?
Leko Business suggests this might actually be a rational survival strategy. Faced with constant economic uncertainty and perhaps unreliable state support, businesses might just decide it's too risky to commit large amounts of capital to long-term projects. It's a sort of rational frugality.
And innovation, which is so crucial for growth, seems to be lagging too.
Yes, and the article makes a good point that traditional economic analysis often focuses too narrowly on technological innovation. It might overlook other important forms, like social innovation, developing shorter supply chains, or building cooperative models.
Leko Business drew a really insightful comparison between Morocco and Tunisia on productivity. What are the key differences there?
In Morocco, the puzzle is that even the most technically productive companies struggle to really dominate the market or gain significant market share. This seems linked to administrative hurdles, rent-seeking behaviors that distort competition, and maybe a lack of dynamic industrial policies to really back winners. Basically, technical efficiency doesn't automatically translate into market success.
And how does Tunisia compare?
Tunisia's situation is somewhat flipped. Their top-performing companies do tend to gain market share, which suggests better resource allocation somehow. However, their overall technical efficiency remains relatively low, so they might be better at grabbing existing opportunities, but not necessarily producing things more efficiently.
So very different development models and challenges. What are the policy takeaways from that divergence?
The analysis underscores the need for a business environment that encourages both individual company efficiency and overall growth. Morocco has often focused on big infrastructure projects and free zones, while Tunisia maybe relied more on market dynamics, but perhaps without enough targeted support for innovation and competitiveness.
And a crucial point raised throughout is the fundamental need for good, reliable data.
Absolutely essential. You need accurate economic data to truly understand productivity issues and design effective policies to address them. And ultimately, real structural change is going to require political Will the courage to shift existing economic power balances and foster healthier competition.
Let's zoom in on some specific countries now. Egypt is facing a concerning industrial decline. According to the Leko Business articles, what are the main drivers of this slowdown?
Egypt's economic growth definitely cooled, dropping from 3.2% in 2023 to 1.9% in 2024. A big part of that seems to be the manufacturing sector collapsing, import restrictions hurting production, and also a decline in traffic through the Suez Canal, which is a major revenue source.
External factors, sure, but there are internal structural weaknesses contributing too, right?
Definitely. Lack of investment in key areas, high inflation eating away at purchasing power, cumbersome bureaucracy hindering business, persistent corruption issues, and just a general deterioration in the climate of trust among economic players.
Yeah.
These are all major breaks on industrial development.
Lico Business floated an interesting alternative take on Egypt's situation, suggesting a possible strategic shift by the regime.
Yeah, the article suggests the government might be deliberately trying to pivot the country towards becoming more of a regional hub for logistics, finance, and tourism, perhaps de-emphasizing traditional industry. That hypothesis also raises questions about whether economic democratization is a prerequisite for any sustainable recovery.
Turning to Syria, the economic picture after the end of the Assad regime in December 2024 sounds even more dire and complex.
Catastrophic is probably the right word. GDP is estimated to have fallen by over 60% since the conflict began, more than half the population displaced. Even with the regime change, the economy kept shrinking in 2024, and forecasts for 2025 weren't looking good either. Extreme poverty is soaring.
And there doesn't seem to be any real economic rebound happening, despite the end of the fighting.
Nighttime satellite imagery, often used as a proxy for economic activity, suggests stagnation or very low activity. Rebuilding Syria is a monumental task infrastructure, reintegrating millions of refugees, reactivating a private sector that's been decimated.
What are the biggest obstacles standing in the way of that reconstruction?
The costs are astronomical, for one. And there's a real lack of willingness, or maybe capacity, from many actors, domestic and international, to commit the necessary funds without lasting political stability. Plus, the Syrian private sector is incredibly fragile. Entrepreneurs fled, the banking system is dysfunctional, markets are fragmented. Most activity is probably informal now.
Lico Business included an important warning about being overly optimistic about reconstruction.
Yes, the article highlights the risk that international aid, if not managed transparently and with a long-term vision, could just end up reinforcing existing patronage networks. It stresses the need for a slow, inclusive rebuilding model rather than trying to quickly restore a pre-war system that might have been inherently unjust anyway.
Okay, let's talk about industrial policies across the MENA region.
Hmm.
What's the general trend observed in different countries?
We're seeing a growing trend of state intervention in the economy. This takes various forms: subsidies, tax breaks, import barriers, setting up free zones. The stated goal is usually to boost local production and attract foreign investment.
But are these state interventions actually effective in achieving industrial development goals?
Lico Business points out several major challenges that limit their effectiveness. Things like institutional fragility, a lack of reliable economic data to guide decisions, the influence of powerful interest groups who might skew policies for their own benefit.
Unequal treatment between state-owned and private firms.
Exactly, that too. Plus, rent-seeking behavior and sometimes backing national champions that aren't really competitive in the market. A big issue is often the lack of rigorous evaluation decisions get made based on political intuition rather than hard evidence of what works.
So what are the prerequisites for making industrial policies more effective in the region?
Strengthening the administrative capacity of states is key. Having reliable, accessible economic data is non-negotiable. And ensuring transparent, accountable governance.
And any concrete recommendations for improving the design and implementation of these policies?
The focus should shift towards correcting actual market failures, reducing competitive distortions, carefully targeting support towards companies with high potential for growth and innovation, and implementing regular, transparent evaluation systems to adjust policies based on results.
The MENA Day region faces this immense challenge. How do you build economic resilience in a context plagued by conflict, climate change impacts, and chronic economic instability? Lico Business even calls it impossible resilience. Is it really a lost cause?
The article definitely questions the feasibility of a truly resilient private sector in that kind of environment. Businesses in the region are often ill-prepared for security, economic, or climate crises, which obviously hinder sustainable recovery.
The impacts are severe.
Extremely. Armed conflicts like those in Syria, Yemen, Libya, Palestine leave deep economic scars, and rebuilding is slow and uncertain. Climate change adds another layer of vulnerability. MENA is one of the most exposed regions, hitting agriculture, crafts, tourism hard, often with limited resources for adaptation or insurance. And then you have the chronic economic instability, volatile oil markets, global supply chain issues, unpredictable trade policies, all dampening private investment.
Yet you do see small signs of adaptation and resistance on the ground, right?
Yes, you see microenterprises finding clever coping strategies, young people innovating digitally, local women's cooperatives emerging. But these initiatives often lack the systemic support needed to scale up and make a broader impact.
Your article also questioned whether the Western concept of resilience even fits the MENA context properly.
Right. The argument is that resilience kind of assumes a baseline level of stability that's often missing in many MENA countries. It also critiques attempts to strengthen the private sector without addressing the authoritarian political structures that can themselves be sources of instability. The suggestion is maybe focusing more on social, local, more frugal economies might be more relevant than just chasing a resilient private sector in a fundamentally unstable environment.
So what would be recommendations for building a form of economic resilience that is adapted to the MENA context?
It would involve strengthening companies' ability to absorb shocks, think insurance, risk management tools, digitalization, targeted crisis support. But equally crucial is improving the broader macroeconomic environment, reducing political uncertainty, clarifying regulations, ensuring secure access to essential resources like energy and water.
Another critical point LECO Business raises is the alarming lack of reliable economic data across the MENA region.
It's a huge paradox, isn't it? You have these urgent economic challenges, but a real deficit in the data needed to understand them properly and design effective policies. This data gap severely hampers government's ability to figure out what interventions actually work. Subsidies, tax breaks, SME support, job programs, you name it.
What are the practical consequences of this data shortage?
It makes it incredibly difficult to assess the real impact of public policies and adjust them. Data at the firm level, especially for the informal sector, which remember can be over 60% of activity, is often scarce or just non-existent.
How can this situation be improved? How can the potential of data be leveraged to inform better economic policy?
Key steps would include making microeconomic data collection from firms more widespread, ensuring public access to anonymized data while respecting confidentiality, developing robust systems for evaluating policies both before and after implementation, and fostering an institutional culture that values transparency and evidence-based learning. Reliable data could allow for much better targeting of support for innovative firms, a clearer understanding of the barriers to formal job creation, and quicker detection of potential economic bubbles. Ultimately, a data-driven economy can help rebuild trust between the state, the private sector, and civil society.
Okay, let's shift focus to Morocco's ambitions now. There's the plan for a major shipyard in Casablanca and a natural gas liquefaction plant in Tendrara. Is Casablanca dreaming of becoming a regional maritime power?
It certainly looks like an ambitious play to position Casablanca as a key maritime hub in Africa. They're leveraging Morocco's extensive coastline and numerous ports, planning upgrades to infrastructure, and aiming to attract large-scale naval projects.
And the new Casablanca shipyard project sounds massive.
It really does. Planned as the largest in Africa, 210,000 square meters, a huge dry dock, a 9,000-ton vertical lift. We're talking a $300 million investment aiming to build around 100 ships by 2040, potentially challenging Spain's dominance in the Mediterranean naval sector.
Are international partners being sought for such a large-scale project?
Yes. The National Ports Agency, ANP, requires potential operators to have at least 10 years of experience and is offering a 30-year concession. There's been high-level contact, like Minister Nizar Baraka visiting HD Hyundai Heavy Industries in South Korea, and reported interest from France's naval group as well.
Some are saying this is an attempt to replicate Morocco's success in the automotive sector, but for the maritime industry.
Exactly. The ambition seems to be to build a strong maritime, technological, and geostrategic position, mirroring the growth achieved in the auto industry.
And the other strategic project, the LNG plant being built in Tendrara. How significant is this for Morocco's energy independence?
Building this natural gas liquefaction plant is a major strategic step towards greater energy sovereignty and cutting reliance on hydrocarbon imports. The goal is local production for local consumption, driven partly by the recent global energy crisis and the need to diversify energy sources.
Could this be described as a kind of energy revolution for Morocco?
Developing its own LNG capacity is definitely a game changer for Morocco's energy security. It's a foundation for building a national gas industry. As one expert quoted in the article put it, control of energy is today a sine qua non of sovereignty.
So achieving this energy sovereignty is really a bet on the future for Morocco.
Absolutely. The plant's expected to start operations around the end of 2025, and it's symbolically huge for Morocco to be tapping its own energy resources. It also gives the country new leverage, diplomatically and economically. An observer noted, "We are moving from a logic of dependence to a logic of resilience. Plus, natural gas is less carbon-intensive than coal and complements renewables like wind and solar in Morocco's push for 52% renewable capacity by 2030, so it's a key part of their energy transition." Investing in liquefaction capacity is strategic in a world where gas is a major geopolitical resource, potentially offering regional autonomy and maybe even future exports within Africa.
Let's switch gears to social issues. Moroccan public sector workers saw significant salary hikes following the 2025-2026 social dialogue. What are the key figures from those agreements?
They were quite substantial. The agreements pushed the minimum net salary in the public sector up towards 4,500 dirhams. That's a 50% increase in under 4 years. The total cost is projected at over 45 billion dirhams in 2026 and nearly 47 billion in 2027. The average net monthly salary in the public sector is forecast to hit around 10,100 dirhams by 2026.
But a significant gap seems to be opening up compared to the minimum wage, SMIG, in the private sector, and the agricultural minimum wage, SMEG.
That's right. The non-agricultural SMIG rose to just over 3,000 dirhams, with another 5% bump planned for Jan 2026. The agricultural SMAG hit around 2,250 dirhams, with a similar increase due in April 2026. This widening gap definitely raises questions about social justice and fairness.
Is the long-term economic sustainability of these public sector pay rises guaranteed?
There are concerns about how it'll be financed, potentially through debt or increased fiscal pressure, especially without parallel deep administrative reforms or broadening the tax base. Some observers even drew analogies to the Greek syndrome, referring to past budget difficulties in Greece.
Could there be political motivations behind these public sector raises?
It's possible the approach aims to secure electoral support from middle-class salaried workers ahead of elections. However, the risk is further alienating private sector workers who feel left behind. It brings to mind John Kenneth Galbraith's observation about the modern state sometimes subsidizing organized middle classes.
Okay, let's end on a potentially very positive note for the Moroccan economy. The discovery of a major chromite deposit in the Serua Massif.
Yes, the Canadian company Catalyst Mines announced finding a chromite deposit valued at potentially over $60 billion in the Serua Volcanic Massif. That's a huge potential economic windfall for Morocco.
Beyond the sheer monetary value, what are the implications of this discovery for Morocco and the region?
Well, chromite is essential for producing chrome, which is used in key industries like automotive, electronics, aerospace, and importantly, in electric vehicle batteries. The reserves are significant, estimated at 609 million tons of ore with promising composition. Plus, the deposit reportedly also contains cobalt and nickel, both critical metals for the energy transition.
How can Morocco ensure this wealth benefits the entire population and contributes to sustainable development in the Serua region itself?
That's the crucial question. Exploitation needs to be managed responsibly, considering the environmental fragility of the Serua region. It's vital that significant local benefits are generated jobs, improved infrastructure like schools and roads, and transparent management of the resources and revenues is absolutely essential for the discovery to benefit the whole country. So to wrap up, this deep dive into the LECO business articles from April 27, 2025, really highlighted those structural challenges facing the MNNO private sector, despite its potential, the still limited but absolutely vital role of women for economic growth, and the sheer complexity of Morocco's informal economy, which needs a really nuanced approach. It's fascinating to see these dynamics play out, isn't it?
Absolutely. And these issues tie directly into Morocco's strategic ambitions within the broader MENA region, as that article, MENA Morocco, an alliance for the future to build, pointed out. The potential for regional alliance is huge economic opportunities, stronger geostrategic positioning, energy cooperation, sharing reform best practices. But of course, the risks from geopolitical instability and regional competition are very real, too. Our guest expert even saw Morocco as a natural extension of its influence within MENA.
Which leaves a key question for you, our listener. Given all these complex dynamics we've explored today, what single factor do you think will be the most decisive in shaping the economic future of the MENA region?
An excellent question to ponder as we conclude this deep dive. We encourage you to keep exploring these topics by following the economic news from the MENA region and Morocco's ongoing development strategies.